Welcome to Hub Headlines. Today's program features the best commentary and analysis published in the Hub for April 11th. Up first is Livio Di Matteo, writing on the outsized economic effects of Canada's cratering self-employment.
Unlike our moribund real per capita GDP performance, the end of the pandemic and the associated economic rebound has seen Canadian unemployment rates return to pre-pandemic lows. Indeed, in early 2023, the unemployment rate had dropped as low as 5%, and even with the economic slowdown brought about by higher interest rates and robust population growth, at 6.1%, Canada's unemployment rate in March 2024 remains low. Over the last 30 years, our unemployment rate has averaged closer to 8%. A factor in low unemployment rates is, of course, employment growth, and while total employment is growing, there are compositional features of that employment that are of concern. Public sector employment is expanding faster than private sector employment and self-employment. Since January of 2014, total employment has expanded by 15%, but the pandemic period was an important shock. In February of 2020, total Canadian employment was 19.2 million people and dropped to 16.1 million in April of 2020 as the economy shut down. Total employment then recovered as the economy gradually reopened, and employment reached the pre-pandemic total of 19.2 million in September of 2021 and stands at 20.4 million in March of 2024. However, when the numbers are examined by class of worker, that is, public sector, private sector, and self-employed, the story of growth is not uniform. A decade ago, the private sector accounted for 65% of total employment, the public sector 20%, and self-employment 15%. At present, the private sector remains the largest employment class in Canada, still accounting for 65% of employment, but the public sector is now at 22% and self-employment 13%. Indeed, since January of 2014, public sector employment in Canada has expanded from 3.5 to 4.4 million workers, a 27% increase. Private sector employment grew from 11.6 to 13.4 million, a 15% increase, and self-employment shrank by approximately 0.5%. The picture is remarkable. From 2014 to the eve of the pandemic, all three sectors appear to have been growing pretty much in tandem. Indeed, from January 2014 to January 2020, public sector and private employment each expanded by approximately 9%, while self-employment expanded by 7%. However, the period of the pandemic marks a shock to the economy with subsequent differential employment growth by sector. From January of 2020 to the present, public sector employment expanded nearly 17%, going from 3.8 to 4.4 million. Private sector employment grew from 12.6 to 13.4 million, an increase of 6%. Self-employment fell from 2.8 to 2.6 million, a drop of 7%. In just the last year alone, the March-to-March increase in public sector employment was 202,000 jobs, while the private sector added 141,000 and self-employment saw the loss of nearly 19,000 jobs. Overall, there has been a pronounced shift in employment growth towards the public sector. And the increase in public sector employment has occurred across the country, though with some variation. Public sector employment growth over the last decade was the highest in British Columbia at 36% and the lowest in Newfoundland and Labrador at 5%. Only Alberta, Quebec, Saskatchewan, and Manitoba saw their employment grow more slowly than the national rate. As a share of total employment, public sector employment declined from a high of nearly 24% in the mid-1970s to a low of 19% by the early 21st century. It then resumed a gradual upward climb, reaching nearly 20% by the eve of the pandemic, and has since settled in at 22%. Private sector employment shares since the mid-1970s, pandemic notwithstanding, are more erratic, fluctuating between 62 and 66%, but averaging 65%. Self-employment rose from a 12% share in the mid-1970s to reach a peak in the late 1990s of just over 17%, and then declined, bringing the share to 15% by the pandemic's eve, and is now 13%. So what is going on here? The drop in self-employment means a drop in small businesses and entrepreneurship. The shock and restrictions of the pandemic were invariably a factor as many smaller and family or individually run businesses decided to pack up shop for good. Some of these individuals may have gravitated towards public sector employment in a reverse flow to that of the mid-1990s when public sector retrenchment led to many former public servants becoming self-employed as independent contractors. More likely, given the aging labor force, they simply have decided to retire from the labor force permanently. Are there implications for economic performance? It is probably not entirely coincidental that our expanding public sector in terms of both employment and GDP share is being accompanied by poor real per capita GDP growth. Indeed, this expansion of the public sector at the same time as rapid population growth and lagging business investment is a further drag on economic performance given evidence of the effects of public sector size on both economic growth and productivity. What may be underway is an example of the Baumol's cost disease effect that explains how wages and employment in labor-intensive sectors increase relative to capital-intensive ones. To attract employment, even in the absence of productivity gains, wages in low-productivity sectors rise to compete workers away from capital-intensive higher-productivity sectors. Government spending, detached from a profit motive and with its focus on labor-intensive services, is often disproportionately affected by Baumol's cost disease. As the spring 2024 federal budget approaches, an important signal will be whether the federal government will begin to address this issue within its own public service. In 2014, there were 257,138 federal public servants, both core public administration and separate agencies. By 2023, there were 357,247 federal public servants, representing a decade increase of 39%, eclipsing both national and provincial public sector employment growth rates. Given that the federal government does not provide either health or education services, nor has it been interested in funding a larger defense establishment, it begs the question as to what the actual demand for this employment is and its value added.
That was a commentary by Livio Di Matteo. He is a contributor to The Hub and professor of economics at Lakehead University. You can find the full text of his article on our website, thehub.ca. Our second essay is an interview between Sean Speer and Ian Brody, where they discuss Justin Trudeau's foreign interference testimony.
As a general rule, the Prime Minister seems to have suggested that he doesn't rely on written briefs. He and his office instead typically use oral briefings, including for, but not limited to, intelligence and national security matters. My experience with Prime Minister Harper is that he received approximately 10 written briefing notes from PMO staff in the Privy Council office each day. Is that consistent with your own experience? And if so, what do you think is lost by minimizing the use of written briefs?
It's true, different prime ministers get their briefings in different ways. Mr. Trump responded to killer graphics, as his CIA director said. In 2006, civil servants had to get used to Mr. Harper reading a lot of long, detailed written notes. Mr. Chrétien liked short notes, to the point. Mr. Harper liked more background material. He got so many notes about the 2007 equalization reform, they filled an entire drawer of a filing cabinet. I really looked forward to days when we only got 10 briefing notes from PCO. Written notes had a big advantage. Mr. Harper initialized every note that he read. We knew the date he received every note and the date he returned it for filing. There was never any doubt about what he'd been briefed and when it had been briefed. Oral briefings are fine, but you need a note taker to record what was said. With really critical information, I prefer to have a paper trail. Plus, if the PM reads the preliminary material ahead of time, the briefing is more productive.
With respect to specific intelligence briefing notes, the Prime Minister said that while he reads them when he can, he instead expects advisors to tell him if there's something important. How does that approach converge or diverge with your experience as the Prime Minister's Chief of Staff?
Every PM relies on others to decide what he needs to see or hear. The fact Mr. Harper read a lot of written briefings every day meant you could send a lot of material his way. In my day, the clerk of the Privy Council had direct access with written notes and verbal briefings. So did I and several PMO staffers. Cabinet ministers, too. That meant there were fewer points of failure. It was rare for a single person to overlook something and leave the PM out of the loop. But nothing lifts the burden of accountability from the PM. He appoints people to make sure he knows what he needs to know. I am sure that several people said, hey, the PM needs to know that China is working hard to get this guy elected as a liberal. Or hey, the Chinese might be threatening an MP's family because of a vote he took in the House of Commons. In the case of Michael Chong, I expect he was briefed about threats to the Chong family. I still don't understand why he didn't instruct someone to check on Chong's family, report back to him, and then let Chong know what was going on.
What was Prime Minister Harper's normal process for consuming national security and intelligence information? Did he have dedicated time each week? Did it typically come in the form of written briefs or oral briefings?
That changed over time. The process became more formal after I left the government. He got a weekly written briefing from the Intelligence Assessment Section at PCO. His various national security advisors would also brief. I visited the main intelligence agencies to make sure we were getting all the right information from them.
In addition to being a chief of staff, you've been involved in leadership races and party nominations. The Liberal Party doesn't prohibit non-residents from participating in its internal voting. The Prime Minister said that that's intentional to encourage wide participation in nomination races. What are the risks in your mind to such a party policy?
Governments should let political parties govern themselves as they see fit. Back in 2006 and 2007, we had informal discussions with the opposition parties about requiring proof of citizenship to vote in a federal election. They were opposed. We couldn't even get an agreement to require photo ID at the ballot box. Without a photo ID requirement, it's hard to enforce a citizenship requirement, even when you set one as my party does. Remember, in the Conservative Party, we let youth members vote even if they aren't yet old enough to vote in a general election. Every party has wider rules for internal votes than the Elections Act does for general elections. However, I personally think allowing non-citizens to vote in a party nomination or leadership election is very risky. They are vulnerable to all sorts of threats, as we have seen at the inquiry. Political parties pick the candidates we get to vote for at election time and pick the leaders of the parties that could become prime minister. To my mind, the qualifications to vote in nomination and leadership races should be the same as the qualifications to vote in a general election. Maybe we should have slightly wider rules for a riding board of directors, but when a party is picking candidates and leaders, that should be a tight process.
That was an interview between Sean Speer and Ian Brody. Sean Speer is the Hub's editor at large. Ian Brody is a professor of political science at the University of Calgary and a former chief of staff to Stephen Harper. That's it for today's edition of Hub Headlines. We hope you enjoyed the program. To receive all our best commentary and analysis each morning by email, subscribe to The Hub for as little as 25 cents a day. You can do that right now at thehub.ca. Hub Headlines is produced by Alicia Rao. Thanks for listening.